So I think we're going to go ahead and get started. First of all, I want to say good morning to all of you in the room. Well, good afternoon, actually, as well as to any of our colleagues that have joined us from Africa online. It's good to see all your faces here and see the folks that have joined us online. My name is Kimberly Holbrook. I work for the Africa region here at the Nature Conservancy, where we are hosting this Africa Biodiversity. Sorry, excuse us, we're having a little technical difficulty here. We're hosting this at TNC, and I am going to start out by giving you a brief overview of the ABCG, the Africa Biodiversity Collaborative Group, and then I will turn it over to Daniel Sopiel, introduce our speaker, and he will present us his work on MMWCA. So the reason why I'm giving the ABCG overview is because Rebecca Goodman, who's our director of ABCG, is actually traveling today, so normally she would do that, but I will go ahead and do it. So, I think we can switch to the next slide. All right, so who is ABCG? ABCG is a community of international conservation and development practitioners who work together to translate their knowledge into practical tools and approaches in order to address high priority conservation challenges, inform policy, and integrate biodiversity conservation into international development agendas. Next slide. Who are the members of ABCG? Currently, we are 7 members, including the African Wildlife Foundation, Conservation International, the Jane Goodall Institute, the Nature Conservancy, Wildlife Conservation Society, World Resources Institute, and WWF. Our aim is to increase our collective conservation impact through advancing the understanding of critical biodiversity conservation challenges and their solutions in sub-Saharan Africa. And we do this using an integrated approach whereby we work with partner institutions to identify knowledge gaps, generate new knowledge, synthesize and disseminate that knowledge, test knowledge through pilot studies, and adopt applicable knowledge. The ABCG members are currently working under 2 thematic working groups, including conservation planning and global health linkages to biodiversity conservation. Within those 2 themes, there are 6 working groups that you can see here on the slide: land use management, global change impacts, community-based forest management, population health and environment, freshwater conservation and WASH, and gender integration. You can connect with ABCG on social media and by following the events by joining the listserv. And the folks that have registered for this ABCG will actually receive a follow-up email with a link to today's presentation. And then the final slide is contact information. Rebecca Goodman is the director of ABCG. You can reach out to her. She's based here in Washington, D.C. And then based in Nairobi, Kenya, we have Evelyn Nambua, our communications and engagement specialist. And before we get started, I realized that I needed to tell everybody that we are recording this presentation. So I wanted to let you know that. And then just a couple of other housekeeping items. Regarding the questions at the end, what we will probably do is, for all of the online participants, you will be muted and we'll ask if you can, if you have questions, to please put them into the chat box. And then we will relay those to Sophia and then he can answer your questions. And for those of you in the room, we may need to ask Daniel, Sophia, we need to ask you to repeat the questions so people can hear what the question actually is. And so with that, go ahead and advance to the next slide. I will introduce Danielle Sophia, who is the CEO of the Maasai Mara Wildlife Conservancies Association. Daniel has been in his role as a CEO for the last 2 years, I believe. He started in October 2017. Prior to that, he was the MMWCA Chief Programs Officer. And then I believe you started your work with MMWCA as chairperson of the Conservancies Council. He's a conservation leader in the region with vast amount of knowledge and strong experience in both the Kenyan Conservancy movement as well as in the tourism sector. Sophia is also on the board of the Kenya Wildlife Conservancies Association, which is an umbrella group covering policy in Kenya around community conservancies, and also on the board of the Greater Mara Trust. And there are more details on the ABCG webpage about Daniel's biography, so you can go there and learn more, as well as the NNWCA webpage. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to you, Sophia, to tell us about your work.
Thank you very much, Kimberly, and good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Like people are still sleeping here. Yeah, my name is Daniel Sophia. I come from Kenya, Maasai Mara. I work for Maasai Mara Wildlife Conservancies Association, which is an umbrella body representing community conservancies in the Greater Mara ecosystem. Thank you very much, Kimberly, and the ABCG, and also TNC for organizing this. And also thank you very much, Nick. I know you've been very instrumental in ensuring that all the stay within DC is very well organized. So thank you very much. So I'm going to take you through some of the work that we do with the community conservancies in the Mara landscape. And the topic of my presentation is about scaling community conservation model. And I think just briefly to mention that within in Kenya, the wildlife industry has been very well structured, where now we have the government protected areas. This is national park, reserves, and sanctuaries, which makes about 8% of the total land. And we have the community conservation model, which is about 11% of the total land. So together combined, we have about 19% of the land under conservation in Kenya with the coming up of the community conservancies model. So talking about the Mara ecosystem, the Mara Serengeti ecosystem. And the Mara Serengeti ecosystem actually covers about more than 15,000 square miles. But the Serengeti itself is about 12,000 square miles, that's about 30,000 square kilometers. And also the Mara ecosystem covers about 4,500 square miles, which is about 6,000 square kilometers. 40% of the total of the African largest mammals are found in the ecosystem, so that just tells you how important the ecosystem to the world is all about. We talk about the Mara itself, as about 35% of all the wildlife in Kenya are actually found in the Maasai Mara. And out of the 25%, we are talking about 70% of all the wildlife in the Mara actually residing within community conservancies. And maybe 30% of them actually found within government protected areas like the Maasai Mara National Reserve, for those of you who have been there. It's home to the wildebeest migration. It's about 2 million wildebeest or animals that are actually migrating every year from the Serengeti all the way to the Mara ecosystem. And come back within a period of 4 or 5 months. They're just ready going back right now as we speak. And it's also one of the 7 wonders of the world, and it's actually made that through the phenomenon of wildlife migration that comes with the ecosystem. So that's really why it matters for us to talk about the Mara Serengeti ecosystem. We're also talking about, it's actually home of the pastoral community, the Maasai people, their culture, that's where we live. Very proud of that landscape. That's where I was born, grew up there, went to school there. We also had the opportunity to go back and work with the communities there. Some of the challenges we actually find in the ecosystem, as you can see, actually 70% of the total populations within the Mara landscape is actually woods. And 80% of this are actually unemployed. And that is really one of the biggest responsibilities we have as an organization and the community conservancies. To ensure that how can the youth, which are the leaders of tomorrow in conservation, be able to actually find conservation for the terms of social and economic balance. Now, the solution to most of these challenges is actually the wildlife conservancies, which I'm actually going to delve a little bit into that. So this is what a conservancy is. When talking about a conservancy, it's basically the Maasai Mara landscape and outside the more protected areas like the National Reserve. No community land has been subdivided 20 years ago. Thousands and hundreds of individual parcels are pulled together to form big wildlife and livestock and tourism land. And it's actually done that through sort of like a governance structure of whereby the community themselves established sort of a legal entity that is actually where all the patterns of individual lands are leased to that legal entity. Then they have sort of like a working relationship with the investors in the landscape. So that is sort of a map of where we work. This is sort of like the Maasai Mara National Reserve. Unfortunately, it's not very, very clear, not very visible. But just sort of in a nutshell, that is the size, that is the National Reserve. They are called greenery. You can see these are the conservancies that are actually bordering the Maasai Mara National Reserve on both ends. And that is sort of the brown sort of an area. It's an area that we are really working hard to bring it into conservation. So pretty much now within the ecosystem, half of it has already been secured, both through the National Reserve and the coming out of the community conservancies in the landscape. So we still have, half of the area, which is more of the brown area. That is an area we are really working hard to bring it under conservation. It's an area that is primarily used a lot by wildlife, the resident wilderness migration, lions, elephants. So basically that is sort of like our vision. How do we bring in more additional land into conservation? So about MMWCA, MMWCA, as I mentioned, is, let's move on. So MMWCA historically came up as a result of the Wildlife Conservation Act of 2013. There before, conservancies were not recognized by law in Kenya as a form of land use. And we actually find that it was very difficult for us to participate in community conservancies, which is actually by then was not recognized by law. So the movement sort of started way back in 2005 all the way to 2012. That's what gets back to the establishments of an umbrella body representing conservancies in the country, that is KWCA, which in the representation is in forms of regions. So we have about 11 regions feeding now to the National Umbrella Organization. And Maasai Mara Wildlife Conservancies Association is just one of the 11 regions that form the Kenya Wildlife Conservancies Association. Now, we began our operations in 2014, thanks to the Nature Conservancy and the USAID for their support. Basically, we'd like to say that without the support of the USAID and also the Nature Conservancies, MMWCA and the Mara Conservancy would have not been where we are today. So big appreciation to that. So this is one of our sort of a seed funding grant that actually supported the development of Maasai Mara Wildlife Conservancies Association as an umbrella body to be able to take on the responsibility. And this was sort of a $4.1 million for 3 years. These are some of the core activities we really focus as an umbrella organization. Sustaining and creating the conservancies. If you look at the sort of the earlier map that I mentioned, we have now the current conservancies, which I'm gonna discuss a little bit briefly about them in detail. And as we have the current existing conservancies, our sort of like vision is creating more while we're sustaining what we have. We're looking at about governance and transparency. That's really very critical for sustainability. We're talking about advocacy and awareness. We're talking to government in terms of policies and legislations that support wildlife conservation in the Mara. We're talking about gender education, which is very, very critical. I think we come in one of the very male-dominated zones because of traditional practices. I was very happy to report that as a result of our interventions today, we have so many women in leadership as well participating in conservation. Sustainable revenue development, looking at livestock initiatives, carbon credit, and so on, like feature-based activities, and also building the capacity for the local to be able to be responsible and participate in conservation activities. This is just a list of some of our local partners that we work together. Of course, Kenya Wildlife Conservancy, I've already mentioned, the MAR Trust, the government of Kenya, the county government of Narok, Maasai Mara University, the Mara Elephant Project, and the Kenya Wildlife Service. So Kenya Wildlife Service, for those of you who do not know, they are these are the government body mandated to protect wildlife within government protected areas. So our responsibility in community conservation is to work very closely with the Kenya Wildlife Service, both in the region as well as in the national. And just going a little bit deeply into some of the programs, let's move ahead. So as I already mentioned that this was a biodiversity conservation and livelihood program supported by the USAID, which was actually meant at creating an integrated sustainable conservancy model and also establishing the regional association to be able to actually participate in this role. That's just basically what I would like to highlight there. Let's move on. And also, this is another very critical and important area in the map, the Padamat conservation area. So most of the conservancies we have are mostly for tourism and wildlife, but allows livestock under a well-managed grazing system. So Padamat conservation area is sort of a different model to the existing conservancies in the landscape. It's an area that was not meant to be a conservancy or a conservation area there before. So mainly it was an area that was meant for people to settle there. With the presence of the wildlife in the area, the community started coming to the MWCA and really request whether we can be able to do something there. And it's actually a different model, maybe for those of you who are familiar with the Northern Rangeland Trust conservancies in Northern Kenya. It's more of a similar arrangement where you have people, wildlife, and livestock living together. So it's more like a mixed model. And that is maybe, this is sort of more of a pilot, and this is something that we really look forward into sort of replicate in other areas that we cannot be able to have core conservancies where we have only tourism. As I mentioned earlier, we have a huge population in the Mara ecosystem as a youth. The rate of the unemployment in the whole country and also in the Mara is quite high. What we are actually doing as an organization is through the support of the Norwegian Agency for Development. We have a program that is running for the next 4 years, starting in 2018 to 2022. And our target is to train about 1,800 youth. 50 of them will have pastoral household women. And we're actually focusing on vocational training skills. Based on the assessment we carried out within the ecosystem, we realized that a number of the youth after schooling were not able to secure jobs or even self-employment because they don't have actually the employability skills that are required in the industry. So we're focusing on plumbing, electricians, basic mechanic, cutlery, guiding, hospitality, and so many allies to enable them to be able to acquire jobs within the industry. And so far, we've already trained nearly 800 of them. We are actually keeping track of those who have already graduated and where they're working, how much they're getting, and also looking at that sort of thing. The reason why this is so critical, that as we look into the next 10, 15 years, this will be the landowners in those conservancies who will determine how conservation will thrive. And if they're actually not actually getting anything from conservation, there's a possibility that they may change their mind and want to do something different for them. So that's why it's very critical for us as an organization and community, conservancies in the Mara, to really focus on that. The other thing is really about this initiative about consolidated and integrated management of the conservancies. We're looking at sustainable livestock initiative, thanks to the Bank Foundation for really supporting this in the conservancies in the Mara. So basically what we are doing is that we're looking at livestock initiative as another alternative revenue income or streams for the conservancies. We have a lot of tourism in the Mara, yes, but I think we also understand how fragile the tourism industry is. And basically, if we are to sustain what we have today, we have to look at other nature-based and compatible land use. And I think livestock initiative, which is a cultural thing, so you cannot actually divert that from that, is a really a critical thing. So how can we ensure that we manage livestock in a sustainable way, in a way that it generates revenue to the community, as well as to conservancy management? Looking at some of our impact with all that interventions. So these are some of the we term as conservancy benefits. And happy to say that this is the only land use we've actually so far found that has so many benefits compared to many other economic land use that we know. Because the key that I just want to focus here, that is really that are very important, is about the guaranteed revenue. This is based on our monthly lease payments. So all the 15 conservancies we have within the landscape, they have about over 15,000 land who are receiving a monthly income that is guaranteed and stable every end of the month for the next 15 or 20 years. That is really one of the biggest impact, and it goes to 100,000 people in terms of households that are benefiting directly. The other thing is about land protection. I think in an area like the Mara where land has been subdivided, it's very vulnerable. People are easily can actually sell land to land speculators who want to do something different. And we actually see the conservancy that are able, due as a result of leasing that land, they are able to register that land in the land control board. And that means we are going to have that land within the community for the next 20 or 25 certified, or as long as that land is actually under the lease. The other thing is the grass paths. We can, I mean, the Maasai pastoral communities, who actually, livestock is a very important livelihood for them, and conservancies at the moment are actually acting as good grazing paths. And that is another really key thing that stands out of the rest. The rest are very important. Like now, the sort of the livestock enterprise that I've already mentioned, businesses, enterprises that actually employment, we're talking about more than 2,000 youths already employed within the camps, and lodges operating in conservancies, as well as ranchers. It's also a very big and steady income that is going to the communities. This is sort of like a very good quote, that the most rewarding thing is seeing my people, local people, getting benefit from wildlife and tourism. People are starting to realize that animals are good and can be economic drivers for the community. So this is just actually one of the, coming from one of the recent graduates of from Koyaki Guided School. So this is some of the conservancy highlights. I've already briefly touched on area under conservation. We're talking about an area close to 1,400 square kilometers, which is equal to the size of Maasai Mara National Reserve. We're talking about over 14,000 landowners who are receiving a monthly guaranteed income. We're talking about a total of $4.8 million. This is the money that's going directly to the households, to those individuals who are leasing land to the conservancy. This figure is actually likely to increase in the next couple of months, because we have conservancy that have just renewed their leases with the landowners for under 25 years, and that means that it's a 60% increase in income. So as we speak, this probably could be nearly going to be $7 million in the next couple of months. We talk about 15 conservancies that are very well established now, that are very well operational. And also we talk about 308 rangers. These are community rangers from the local community. We talk about 47 camps, but actually the ones that are supporting the area under conservation, and they're the ones that are actually paying for the leases for the landowners. And 41%, and that, I mean, that's sort of the number of women that is in landowners committee. Basically, that is the conservancy's boards. When we started this like 4 or 5 years ago, before the coming of MWCA, we had zero women in conservancy's boards. That is really something that we work so hard as an organization to make sure that the women and the youth are also equally represented in conservation. Some of the ecological impact, I mean, we have 46% of the area increased now under conservation. In terms of wildlife corridors, we've managed to secure some of the very critical wildlife corridors linking the reserve and the conservancies and individual conservancies. Conservancies at the moment, they have about the highest lion density population. And this was an infrastructure development supported under the USAID program, in having 4 conservancies, having about 57 kilometers of road that was sort of open up, which is really helping them for tourism. What next are we focusing on? So these are some of the priorities we're really looking into. It's about opening up space for wildlife. Earlier mentioned that area in the map, the brown areas that we really want to bring, and we definitely need to make sure that we use research as we now expand the conservation efforts in the Mara. Looking at the diversified conservancy revenue streams, livestock initiative and carbon are some of the examples that I've just already given out. And we're really looking into that. Improve awareness and support of the conservancies, both at the local and international level. Catalyze environmental social projects, and also strengthening the institution internal capacity and also collaboration. So these are just to mention some of the very key steps and priority for us as we look forward. One of them, as I mentioned, is research. It's an engine for sustainable conservation. We all agree that research is very important. Data is really required when we're talking about expansion, scaling it up, economic impact, social impact. Research is very key. A lot of research has been done in the Mara. Unfortunately, up to date, we don't have some of these findings available. Mostly done by research students. Probably there was no way to track this data. And this is something that we are thinking across the ecosystem, how do we make sure that we have robust ecological and social monitoring within the landscape. So that's really one of just the important thing that we're really focusing strongly going forward alongside the rest that I've just mentioned.
And this is just basically an explanation of a collaborative conservation stakeholders create an ecosystem, whether to coordinate research, increase case and pace of conservation interventions in the critical landscape. And these are some of the partners that are already going to be working together with us: Smithsonian Institutes, Colorado State University, Oxford University, together with other local universities in the country. This is more just a proposed structure, subject to change. And this is how, so we have one MARA research hub, which is going to be very central. And this is basically how the whole structure is sort of formulated. So this is just basically an extension of what the objectives are: communicate scientific and conservation inputs, a platform for knowledge exchange and data sharing, communicate scientific and conservation outputs, build steps and capacity of the local communities, and also organize research meetings and annual conferences. So this is basically some of the objectives of the research, the One MARA research that we are really thinking about. And this is some of the steps that have been made so far. We have Kenya Wildlife Trust, which is basically going to be an implementing partner. This is more of what has already happened this year. In July, we had a fencing conference in the MARA where we have about more than 20 conservation organizations attended to really look at the scope of the fences in the ecosystem and what's really happening. The steering committee, we have a coordinator already appointed. And the BESCAL is now working in terms of compiling the existing data to date so that we can be able to know what we have, what's missing, what we need to focus on. And that basically defines the priority. This is partners who have met some of the work possible in the MARA, the Nature Conservancy, the USID, the DICU, that's the Norwegian Agency for International Development and Vocational Training. We got also the Smithsonian Institute, we got the Lanchester Global Trust, also in Europe supporting our work, and those are some of the other local partners that we work together in the landscape. And I think that basically brings us to the end. We're going to have a video that we're probably going to play for you before we can now move to questions.
We have a total of 15 conservancies covering an area of 1,400 square kilometers, which is equal to the size of Maasai Mara National Reserve. Within the 15 conservancies, we have a total of over 15,000 landowners drawn from different families who are receiving monthly income through conservation and tourism.
This is actually a model that is perfectly balanced between natural biodiversity and poverty alleviation.
One of the key things is that the communities themselves are under the forest. They are living in the forest.
What I like about the as Mamanga, or maybe University, what is the Shamba? I am a Shamba. But I am now who got in the Shamba. My guy who is the Shamba, like I am in Yamagaka.
How many of the limited to man? Where is Shamba? Like a little of us in the Puget. Let's go with him. Let me get a little money. Let me remember my own.
the conservancy model has proven to be the best way to protect wildlife and the big cats outside of the fully protected areas like the National Reserve.
Communities can set aside their land, give habitat for wildlife, and then provide a valuable income.
What is that language? The you.
The major challenges we face in the greater ecosystem are land privatization and subdivision, and this has led to land sales, and also people coming up with the fences, which in turn block the wildlife migratory corridors. And the desire from the landowners to commit more land to conservation is quite high, but the challenge is that we don't have enough resources that we can be able to lease this land and secure it for the next 15 years.
And we're believing that the Maasai Mara Conservancy Association is really the key body to enable this and to link with international donors. So there's a huge opportunity here to actually be able to provide funding to help secure this habitat for fences to be brought down and to create new conservancies.
Only by working together that we are sure that we are able to safeguard and to save the future of one of the most emblematic and important ecosystems we have left on Earth.
Thank you very much.
So I have sent a note to the online participants to encourage them to send any questions our way, but if there's anyone here in the room that would like to ask a question, I welcome you to do that. Yeah.
Thank you, that was fabulous. Just a joy to be part of that for a minute here. So I'm curious about a couple of things. These lands are being leased from communities. So they do have private rights over these lands, or do they have communal, do they hold communal lands over the lands and then hand over the communal lands to them? Just curious about that. But I'm also curious about what happens when they lease their lands. What happens to them? What do they use their money for? When they lease their lands, it appears that they might buy lands or lease lands elsewhere. And so that might be a problematic issue that you're addressing. Is that why you need all this research to figure out what happens once the money goes into the hands of these households?
Thank you. So in terms of the structure, what happened there is that community themselves, so land has been subdivided, privatized, so most of those landowners, they own
titles.
So what happened is that they come together and they form their own company, local company, where that company becomes the landholding company. So each and every individual will lease their land to that company, which is owned by the community. That company has a board, which now negotiates with the tourism operators or the investors in the conservancy. So basically the board invites the investors to come and sort of like put lodges or camps in the conservancies. And therefore, they have to make sure that they pay a revenue that has been agreed to those individual landowners. So it's very transparent. The revenue goes directly to the individual's bank account. So it doesn't go through like community pool or kind of things like that. So the structure is very clear. Each and every landowner holds a lease with their own respective company, and the company negotiates on their behalf through the representations. So that is how, and they still have some rights over the land, even though it has been leased, so they can still be able to graze the livestock there. There are some of the prohibited things that like charcoal burning or stations, so they cannot be able to do that. And when it comes to grazing, there's a way the conservancy has designed the sort of a managed grazing system that is rotational. So that is very much taken care of by the conservancy management. Now, in terms of the other question about what do they do with the lease fee they actually receive, they spend on education. That is really one of the biggest things we sort of find that they are spending a lot of money on education. The other thing they're spending more their money is basically on their daily lives, in terms of food. foodstuffs and clothing. And some of them also have to, they actually get loans from the bank because of the guaranteed income that is going for coming to their bank account for a long period. They're also able to secure a loan from the bank. That's the money they can now use to purchase more extra land elsewhere, that they can actually decide to go and live, or they can be able to do something else different. So the conservancy in our context, it does not actually evict people out of their land. But it's a willingness for the landowner to lease your land when you have somewhere else to live.
Aswani, could you describe a little bit more about the land use going on in the areas that are not in conservancies? What are the patterns there? Are they still grasslands? Have they been converted to agriculture? What is the situation in those
lands? I mean, within the ecosystem now, the land that is under conservancies is very secured. It's very okay. We don't have a problem there. The problem is the land that is not leased to the conservancy, because there's a lot of other sort of computing land uses that's been happening. One is that there's a lot of land speculations in the Mara, so people from other parts of the country are actually coming to the Mara to buy available land with intention to wanting to develop a tourism facility, a home, a golf club, or something that's different to that. As a result of that, and also because of the privatization, we have a lot of fencing that is really coming up on a daily basis. And basically, that is the major threat we have in the landscape, the fencing that is coming up. So people want to buy a piece of land, the first thing they want to do is to fence that off, to identify it. And then you could think of what to do next after that. So that is really the major problem we have at the moment. We don't have sort of like plowing of land for growing of maize, wheat, or anything like that, because I mean, Mara is an arid area as well. So although it's good for agriculture, but because of the presence of wildlife and the changing weather patterns, it's definitely not the best land in Sofia at the moment. So a few people still have an idea that I buy the land, but I will think of what to do with this land in the future. Could be to set up a facility, could be to sell to somebody else. That is kind of what's trending at the moment. And that's why now our biggest sort of concern is how do we secure that land that is already outside there before it changes hands and it becomes very complex and very difficult and very expensive. Get it back.
To clarify, the 15,000 landowners don't live on that land anymore.
They don't live on the land that is leased, but they live outside the conservancies.
So yeah. The Pardamat?
Pardamat, yeah.
Will that mean there some of them will be still in the region?
Exactly. So in Pardamat now, we have so many of those landowners actually now sort of living in Pardamat because it's more of a dual mixed land use where you have people, livestock, and wildlife living there. As I mentioned earlier, it was an area that was designed for settlement during the subdivisions. So you've got most landowners, they've got a piece of land in the conservancy, and then you've got another small piece of land in Parliament. So that's why you see now the density of settlement is quite intense and high in Parliament, just because of how it was initially designed. So what basically we're trying to secure. It's very important by the diversity area within Pardamat, along the hillside, for example. Make sure that elephants and all the wildlife are still able to go to Pardamat and connect with the other conservancies. And basically, so that's basically what we're doing. So we're not intending to lease the whole of Pardamat, but we're looking at areas that are very rich for biodiversity and also allow the landowners to live in the other side.
I have a question about the equitable distribution of money coming in. One, are women's names on the title deeds? How is the money distributed and to women equally? And is there still a 19% fund that the government has to distribute 19% of their income to the conservancies, and is that still operational, and how is that distributed equitably?
So in terms of equity, in terms of how we share the revenues in the conservancy, it's basically based on land ownership, for example. I mean, traditionally, women don't own land, I mean, not only in the Maasai tradition, but also basically across the country. However, we have women that actually own land in conservancies. and they own land through either inheritance, meaning the husband passed away, and therefore the title was actually changed to the wife. So we've got quite a good percentage, because we definitely track and we monitor. We have quite a good percentage of women that actually have their names in their title deeds. Therefore, they are the ones that are leasing the land. We have those who have also bought land through maybe they are working somewhere else and they actually been able to buy some piece of land. So in terms, the bigger, the majority are the males who actually own the land, but we still have also the number of women that own the land and they actually get a monthly income as a result of that. What also happened there is that in as much as the man owns the land, the money is actually shared within the family. And the conservancy has provided that sort of platform where if, for example, the husband go and get the money and he doesn't take the money back home, we have to deal with some of those issues, where they come and go to the conservancy management and we are able to stop the payment until they come up with a very clear structure and agreed way of sharing the revenue. It could be a way of sort of sharing and say that this percentage should go to his wife, this percentage should go to the husband. So we've been able to sort of really solve some of those issues. Regarding the 19% from the National Reserve, which was intended to go to the group branches in the reserve, which now is actually the conservancy. We, as conservancy, do not receive that money from the government. Those are the money that are actually spent by politicians, the member of county assemblies. They spend that money mostly on sort of infrastructure development, building of classrooms in schools, buildings or equipping maybe some hospitals within the area. So there's no a very clear structured way of that money reaching to the community. One of the biggest debates we've been having with, as an umbrella organization, with the county government, is how about channeling the 19% through MMWC as an umbrella body, and therefore, we could equally distribute to the 15 conservancies and even beyond. Because even as we think about the current existing conservancy, our more concern as an organization is about those areas that really need to be protected, need to be conserved. And we were even ready to say that, can that money even go to areas that are not currently within the conservancies? Let's go to the Loita, let's go to Loita Plains, Loita Forest, and there are areas like that. So there isn't that sort of conversations at the moment. We've been in discussion for quite some time now. The possibility of when that will happen and how, we don't know. So it's basically whatever at the moment is coming through the conservancies is through the private investments from the tour operators and also through the support of international donors and philanthropists that are actually supporting the market. So not really a commission to conservancies.
We have one question online, actually a comment and a question. The comment is, the pressure to subdivide once communal land in Kenya is growing. How big, growing dramatically, that is. How big a trend is this in the Mara? And what strategies are in place to manage or counter this trend?
Great. I think basically in the Mara, we've sort of like, I think we're already there. We are suddenly even out of that. Because the whole sort of area that is not within the government protected areas has already been subdivided. These were group ranches. There were nearly eight of them at the beginning, and almost all of the eight of them has already gone through privatization and subdivisions. The only way to secure any sort of private land for conservation is through a lease program, or maybe through easements. I think there's no any other way that I can probably recommend. It's either through easements or it's through the lease payments. That pressure is growing in Kenya because of a number of reasons. I think if you look at the northern Kenya, it is still communal land, some are still trust lands. And I think sooner or later, all these areas will be subdivided. People are worried about land grabbing. People are worried about the issue of lack of transparency when it comes to sharing of these revenues. People are worried about upcoming infrastructure developments from government and all that, so the railway, highways and all those kind of things, that will be possibly forced acquisition from government to utilize those sort of land. So sooner or later, I think the issue about land privatization and subdivision in Kenya is really gonna be coming high in demand. And I think what we told people is that probably may not be the best solution when it comes to conservation, But I think we in the Mara have already demonstrated an alternative way to keep that land under conservation as and when it comes to be subdivided. And basically, today we have lots of people coming from Northern Kenya, from Amboseli area, from other areas in the country, as far as even Tanzania, Uganda, and Namibia, actually coming to look at the Mara model. Because I think it's so far the only model that is based on sort of private land ownership, and so far it's been working. So I don't think there is sort of a way to stop anything to do with the change of communal land ownership to private land ownership. It's something that's going to happen for sure. Politicians are even pushing more for that. Communities want to push it because they're worried about the future of what's going to happen. I think the most important thing is about the level of preparedness and whether we have some of the models like the Mara that can take care of such as and when it happens.
I have a question actually about the fences. It does sound like that's the biggest challenge that you have now. And I'm curious what are the best methods you've found to convince resistant landowners? Or how do you convey the importance of not having fences in the landscape?
One that I can talk of that has been working is basically to lease. As I said earlier, when you own land, you have the absolute rights to do what you want for that piece of land. I think the only way to secure any private land, in my view, is to go back to either leasements or leasing land, because you buy development rights. That is the only way, and that is really what makes it a little bit complex and expensive as well. Because how we've been approaching that in an area like Pardama, because that's where we have a lot of fencing, is basically convincing and encouraging those landowners to accept to lease the land to the conservancy. As a result of that, we have to take the cost of demolishing the fence. So we put down the fence and then we lease that land. Because even if a landowner comes to you and say, "Oh, I actually want to pull down my fence, just maybe because you need money for something," then maybe 2, 4, 5 months down the line, you probably want to put it back. So the only way is that we agree, you lease, we pull down, then you lease it and we register it. And then that's when we feel that we've secured that piece of land for the next 15 years or 20 years. So that is the only way to manage that issue. Through the support of the USAID funding, we've actually pulled down a number of fences in Parliament Conservation Area. And I'm glad that the likes of the LGT and the NORAD and the rest are also sort of like buying into the idea of maybe sort of claiming those land to pull down fences and then lease it. But more importantly, it's about the land that is not yet fenced, how do we secure it before that happens? I think to me that is the most important thing.
Yeah. We
might ask that you speak up because we heard that some people can't hear perfectly.
We need to come closer a little bit.
Well, the questions, or maybe you can just repeat the question before you answer it. I have another question, but I'm going to give it over to you.
This question of how do you keep the land prices in a way that doesn't bring in people from the outside to speculate? I mean, it's just a tough but fascinating question. So I have a couple of questions, thoughts on this, and questions related to those thoughts. One is whether really the only way is to put some regulations in place that would enable you to acquire the land a little bit more easily. You know, who knows what those regulations are, that they would be locally specific. So one question is how much of an effort do you place on changing policy? You know, so that's one question. The other question is, the fencing strategy works if all the landowners remove their fences where the beasts go. So you take this out, but that stays and that stays, then you're squeezing the beasts through a spot. So one strategy that people have tried to bring a group of people together is to offer something called an agglomeration bonus. So if you're able to bring your neighbor too along with you, you get a slightly better rate or whatever it is, that, you know, the easement or the sale that you're trying to make. So that enables you to bring a larger group together versus just a single. So I'm just wondering if things like that have been tried, where you provide a slightly higher rate and you can agglomerate the fence removal.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I think your question on how do we cap or sort of manage the sort of speculations around land prices and whether there's anything in terms of policy level to address some of these issues. I think we haven't actually gone further to the idea about incentivizing the landowner more. If, for example, you are able to convince your neighbor to actually pull down a fence, for example, it could be some of the maybe ways to really think as we go forward. I think what we've done, so in terms of land speculations, I think that one is very tricky. Because when you look at land subdivisions and the way it has happened, you definitely do not have control of people or who they are talking to, who are they selling the land to. We've, however, encouraged, even in the conservancy level, that because we knew that people have to sell land anyway, because they have needs they want to meet and kind of things like that. We've tried to convince them within the lease structure, if the conservancy can be given the first right of refusal, in a way that if I want to sell my land, and I must sell my land, I'll have to sell to a landowner in that conservancy, so that we don't have to change the land use. The land ownership can change, but the land use cannot change.
So if you were to, for example, if there was a regulation that said that you would get a tax break if you sold to a conservancy versus somebody else, that might also have the same, that might have an incentivizing effect. Anyway,
that is one way we've tried our best. And yes, we've had a few landowners who have sort of really respected that and agreed to that, and they have sold their land to the conservancy. We still have those landowners. And the problem here, when you talk about land speculations, we don't have policy that deter that.
Right.
So if somebody comes and offer you 3 times what the conservancy was offering, of course you go to the other parcel. That is where the problem is. So what we've been trying to think from the policy level to the county government, which is basically now that controls the land within the area, is that they should be able to sort of put a moratorium to the issue when it comes to land. First of all, that they have to put a limit in how much you can subdivide your land to. Because most people, they are looking at a land of 10 acres, 5 acres, 20 acres at most. So what we're trying to encourage the government is to come on policy that you can also divide your land below 50 acres, for example. That suddenly itself might put some limits there in terms of how people can buy the land. Because you find somebody buying 5 acres, just wanted a place for a camp, and he doesn't care what happened outside there. And they're not even putting money to lease more land. So that is really one effort. The other thing, when I talk about the KWC, the Kenya Wildlife Conservancies Association, it's more of a policy level. So they work with the national government on policy. Currently, we have the 2016 Land Act, Community Land Act. So there's been a lot of revision. There's a lot of things that's happening on the policy level, where KWC is playing a very key role there. We in the county and the regions are working with the county governments, because they also determine on the land use. So that is happening on both levels, but I think I probably can say that there isn't so much tangible results and outcome we can probably talk about. So the conversation is still ongoing. That's where we want to go, talking with the politicians, and you know how policy takes a long time. It's based on trust, based on relationships, and by the time you have even reached sort of like a step further, then you got maybe there's a change in the organization, there's a change in government, and you get somebody else different, you got to start everything from zero. So those are some of the hurdles. But I'm optimistic that as we continue with this conversation and the way the wildlife industry has been structured now in the country, where we have the community, then we have the government working very closely together, we will be able to achieve something. Problem is that the rate in which the land conversions is happening and the population growth and the climate change is going to be a big, big thing to raise at any time. Yeah.
So we have 2 minutes left. I'm going to hold off on my question and ask you later. Do you have a few minutes afterwards, 5 or 10 minutes to chat, or do you have to?
Yeah, sure. Okay. Absolutely.
All right. So Lex, did you want to ask a question?
I'm just curious if there's any kind of interesting shifts in terms of how different conservancies are evolving. So we work with 15 or some that are sort of, you know, really changing in interesting ways, either good or bad.
Thanks.
Just maybe repeat the question.
You mentioned about how the conservancies, whether they're in different levels.
Yeah, whether they either started out in different ways or whether they evolved, if some communities are really, like, you know, progressing well, what are the reasons for that?
Yeah, in terms of governance model, particularly, because that's what it boils down to, they are all, the 15 conservancies are sort of in different stages. And I think this goes back to when actually this conservancy was established and how it was established. Within the 15 conservancies and in the landscape, we did not have sort of like a strategic guidance on that. This is how you develop a conservancy. So it has been more of evolving organically. It's been based on trial and error, learning from their counterparts on what is working in your conservancy, how do we avoid these kind of things like. But with the coming of the umbrella organization now, we are sort of our work is to make sure that there's proper coordination and strengthening the conservancy's governance model, building on transparency and all those kind of aspects. So they have sort of survived themselves and grown organically over the last 6 years before MMWC came to be. But I think now we are sort of, we've developed sort of a framework that sort of like guide them on what sort of the tick box should look like in terms of governance. How does it look like in terms of management? What do we need to see there? All those kind of things like that. So it's beginning sort of now to come into a position that they're actually sort of now at par at the moment. But as and when they were developed, they were all in different sort of levels. How much this pay is different to how much this one's pay. The lease period in this is different to this one again. The conservancy management is maybe different to this one. So there was a lot of inequality in all those aspects. But at the moment, we're sort of really trying to bring them to the same level. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you also all for coming, and thank you for listening, and thank you for your question. It's a pleasure to share what we do in the MARA.
Thank you.
Good.